The date is January the 15th, 1979. This is an interview with Lieutenant General Lane by Dr. Arch Roy. Right.
Well, I arrived at Mobile Command Headquarters. It was located and still is located at St. Hubert, just on the edge of Montreal. Arrived there in the summer of 69. And immediately went into my job as deputy commander of Mobile Command. Now, Mobile Command was really almost a joint command of air and land. By this time, Mobile Command had operational control over the CF-5 squadrons, the tactical fighter squadrons, and all of the helicopter squadrons that were originally parts of the various army formations, such as the recce squadrons and each of the battalions, infantry battalions at one time, and had a couple of choppers for recce purposes. But they were all brought together into squadrons. And so the air part, the tactical squadrons and the helicopter squadrons, became a part of a tactical group, which was under the operational command of the commander of Mobile Command. Whereas the army formations, they were the old, basically the old organization of using the main camps such as Calgary, Petawawa, Gagetown, Valcartier, as groups, army groups, with various formations attached to those groups. And even those units which were not co-located, for example, when we first arrived, I guess it would be the guards were at London, and they were very rapidly changed to the RCRs. There were other organizations like that spread around, the PPCLI. They had one of the battalions was in Winnipeg. They had elements at the Griesbach Barracks just outside Edmonton, very close to Namail, as opposed to the group headquarters, which was located down in Calgary. So they were scattered all over, well, then the PPCLI battalion that was here in Victoria. But they were all organized into groups, with the headquarters of each group being one in Valcartier, one in Gagetown, one in Petawawa, and one in Calgary. There were the four groups. So we had those were the higher formations of the land, and then the tactical air group, which controlled all the air in the command. All of those groups reporting right to the headquarters. Now, my function as deputy commander, of course, was, as its name implies, when the commander was away, I was responsible for the operation of the headquarters and the command. This happened frequently because the commander, there was a lot of traveling involved, naturally, with a command as big as that. And then there were conferences in the States, and there were conferences in Europe, NATO conferences, and so forth. So the commander was away an awful lot, and when he was away, then I literally was in command of the command. And then I had other functions, which were such things as to screen the estimates, put together the estimates. I had a lot of things came up through me. Most of the stuff came up through me on the way to the commander. He was very good. The commander at that time was Lieutenant General Gilles Turco, who was extremely good in ensuring, I suppose, perhaps he was being very smart. He was getting another approach, another look at things. In other words, an unbiased look, if you will, because many of the army things that had no air implication at all would come up through me, and I would have to comment on them. Mm. And in that way, he was getting at least another look at it, which didn't have any either regimental or corps tie. It was an unbiased opinion. Mm. And as a result of that, I felt very much a part of the command, although it was an army command, no two ways about it. And I got along extremely well with Gilles Turco. I found him a very easy man to work with, a very pleasant man to work with. And I was always, I think primarily because he always did seek my opinion. Whether he How much notice he took of my opinion, of course, one would never know, because in the long haul of things. But at least he did seek it, and we had some pretty good discussions, if not arguments, on some occasions.
Yeah.
And, on matters of principle and various approaches to the command.
Well, now, what was your command supposed to do if the balloon went up?
Yes, well, Mobile Command had, I guess it would be three primary functions, perhaps even four. One was, of course, a mobilization base for the expansion and the formation of a full-blown army if there was time to do so in the event of hostilities, particularly if it should start off as a conventional war.
Yeah.
And the conventional war concept was very much to the fore at that time.
Mm.
The old threshold concept, where you would, anyone steps over the threshold, then you would have an increasing degree of severity in the response to that stepping over the threshold.
Mm-hmm.
It was an American strategic concept, but it was prevalent at that time. So there was a need for a mobilization base. The second was, of course, there was a need immediately to take care of to flush out the brigade group in Europe at that time, because it was short of a lot of people to make it a completely and fully operational organization.
Yeah.
The shortfall in their establishment and in their strength was nothing more than, going back to the time I was in the Air Division, I referred to the constant reductions, to the point where the brigade was almost decimated, you might almost say emasculated, from being a proper, recognized land fighting formation.
Mm-hmm.
So that was known. Now the third one, and this was a big one, particularly when it came to exercises, was to provide the fighting force for the Scandinavian wing of NATO.
Northern flank.
The northern flank. The need to move rapidly the formations that were required to help the Norwegians to protect that northern flank, and that included both air and land forces.
By air you mean the CF-105?
The 105s. Yes, the 105s and the choppers and the helicopters. They had to have helicopters as well. So there were squadrons, there was a helicopter input, and there was a CF-5 squadron input. Yeah. And, of course, I forget exactly the number of units that were involved, but it was significant, a significant contribution. It was a big lift, a heck of a big lift to get them there. And the concept was fine on paper. It came apart at the seams because logistically there was no support. You'd get them there with what they had on their backs, and then where do they go? And if they ever got into a shooting war, of course, they wouldn't be able to last very long without good, long, strong logistic support.
And presumably the only way you could do that would be by air, at least for the first instant.
Yes, the Norwegians did agree to provide some stuff, like POL. I think there was some agreement on some ammo. But after that, and any if consumption in a shooting war, as it will go up, escalates enormously, then there was just no way. They wouldn't last. They can't last very long, and you're quite right. The support is going to have to come through our own logistics lines or a tie-in with the American line or something like that, which up in the northern flank is not going to be just that easy. So when I left, there was still a great deal of work to be done to sort out the logistic support of a fighting formation. But nevertheless, I suppose in part it was political. It was Canada's contribution, another contribution to NATO, that would only be required to be located overseas in the event of hostilities. And therefore, it was a gesture, if you will, a political gesture, that Canada, yes, was going to do this and would do it. The military aspects of the thing still hadn't been completely sorted out, and I'd read recently where the minister had been up, and I say recently, in the last, 18 months, where the minister had been up to Norway, and again they were talking and discussing the business of prepositioning, the logistic support that they required, vehicles and so forth.
This is something that I was going to bring in. It seems to me that at that time, and I think maybe even today, there was a very great reluctance on the part of the Norwegians to permit any, shall we say, foreign soldiers being stationed in Norway.
Which is part of it. You're absolutely right. Norway is absolutely against any foreigners, particularly armed forces, being located on their soil. So prepositioning of stores means that, in accordance to abide by that law, means that they would have to be looked after by the Norwegians. So you've got an additional overhead expense. Not only have you got the cost of putting the stuff there, but then the maintenance of it would have to be by civilians and Norwegians, and so you've got an additional cost. Yeah. It's not like as if it would have been the Army's responsibility or Mobile Command's responsibility, and they would have taken a few people out of their various units, the depots, put them up there to look after the stuff, do the running maintenance on them that was required, the checks to make sure that everything was up, the batteries, all the usual stuff that goes on when equipment is in relatively long-term storage.
Yeah.
Should go back.
But from an exercise point of view, it was a great one because it moving those forces to Norway for a NATO exercise was put a great strain on the whole damn organization, the airlift of Air Command, of Air Transport Command, and everything else. And they were true tests. They didn't hold them very often because they were very expensive, but when they did, they were great training. Then another function, of course, was in being prepared to assist the military, the civilian authorities in any way, whether it be a disaster of a flood, fire, any kind of a national emergency, and not the least of which, of course, would be something in the way of not revolution, but where the security of a city or an area was of concern, and the military authority, the civil authorities felt they could not control and needed the support of the military.
In aid of a civil power.
In aid of the civil power, exactly. Which. And there's an interesting thing on that which I don't think many people realize, and that is that every premier of a province has the authority to write directly to the chief of the defense staff to ask for his support in assisting him. And the chief must abide by that request. He cannot refuse that request. And then if the federal government wants to get into the act, then they have to get in and get together with the province. It's a direct chain, which is not realized by many people. It's not premier to prime minister or anything like that. It goes on a direct net.
Well, in the old days, Reg, what was it? Either three or four magistrates from a local area could call upon the militia to come out in aid of a civil power.
No, I don't think that is. I don't think that applies anymore. At least I had not heard of that one.
Yeah.
In really, it comes down to where it's the adjutant general, I suppose, in the province, when he puts it on writing.
The attorney general.
The attorney general, rather. When he puts it in writing and he writes and says, "I need help," and it goes to the federal government, to the CDS, and then that's really all that's required. Now, when you get down a bit further down the line, the question of the magistrates asking for assistance and so forth, no, I hadn't heard of that kind of
that
authority. And I would be rather surprised when it really only takes a phone call up the line from a magistrate to the provincial, what could be the deputy, whoever would have the authority to speak for the attorney general. But there was aid to the civil power, and as it happened, that became a big issue a little later. And then part of the normal function of the command was to train, organize and train the reserves, the reserve forces. So all the reserve forces, basically, in Canada, with the exception of the Navy, were under the command of Mobile Command. And that brought in the Air Reserve, as well as all the militia. So the command was a fairly large one. I guess we must have had our strength at that time was about 19 to 20,000 regulars, and the strength of the reserves was about 16,000, 17,000. It did fluctuate quite a lot. The ceiling, though, I think was the number of reservists permitted was up around 19,000, as I recall. I remember we never were up to full strength. Well, when I arrived there, I spent quite a bit of time, of course, catching up with the organization, the roles, the functions, just finding out what the hell the command was about, because it's one thing to know in general terms what a command does, but it's another thing to suddenly find yourself in command. You've got to dig in pretty fast and to get yourself up to speed. So I spent quite a bit of time, and I visited a lot of the units to meet the commanders and get to know the various unit commanders as well, and it was great fun, because I had never had the opportunity to visit most of those bases before, or if I had, it was very fleeting visits in an airplane, in and out after a quick meeting, that sort of thing. And here I was spending a day or two, and using that lovely old phrase, walking the orchard, to see what the whole thing was like. And it was. I got out onto all the ranges. I tried to get to see what made the command geographically tick. So that when it came to discussions, I knew at least what the hell we were talking about geographically. Mm-hmm. And that included getting even up into Newfoundland and visiting some of the reserves in Newfoundland and some of their training areas. But as a result of that, I learned a hell of a lot very quickly. And I found many, many areas where I was appalled at the conditions under which the troops were operating. For example, the Signals Regiment was located in Kingston, and I have never seen such a terrible accommodation in my life as the SIGS Reg were operating. I didn't believe it. I literally didn't believe it. I thought that kind of accommodation had gone out before World War II. There they were.
What did they have?
Huh? They were huts, and they no heat, and they were all leaking. The roofs were leaking. It was cold when I was there my first trip. It was getting into the winter, and you had ice on the floors and this sort of thing. You wouldn't have believed it. You truly wouldn't have believed it. And as a result of that, a little bit further downstream, one of my responsibilities was to put together the future plan and requirements, and which included new construction. And I talked to the commander, and we agreed that the SIGS regiment had to have some decent accommodation. It wasn't a question of moving them, because all the SIGS people were more or less concentrated in the Kingston area. All the signal training was down there. And we kind of wanted to keep it there. But and the SIGS mess, so there was a lot of tradition associated with Kingston for the signals. The signal people. So we wanted to keep it there, but we sure as hell had to do something about getting them some decent accommodation. And it still, even when I left, we were still having trouble getting money to provide them with accommodation. Again, we went through a period of the ceiling. See, no more money. And of course, with escalating costs, it really meant a cut. That's really what it boiled down to, because inflation was taking place, and there was just no money. So that major programs were the things that suffered, just trying to keep money, enough money for the maintenance, the operations and maintenance of the organization, much less money for capital outlay.
Yeah.
And we had other major problems which had an impact on the budget. The vehicles, all the vehicles were terribly old. And I remember one figure, it was costing about some of our military pattern vehicles, the trucks, it was costing something like $1.73 an hour, a mile, to keep the goddamn things going. It was just unbelievable. They'd go in for repairs, and everything had to be handmade. Spare parts were unattainable, and they literally had to be hand-produced. Reliability, the vehicles, when you took them out on an exercise, you just didn't know how many miles they were going to go before they came apart at the seams. Terrible. Just terrible. I was shattered. As fundamental difference, and I guess this is why I was so shattered. Air Force people are equipment oriented, because it's the equipment that is the end all and the be all, meaning a weapon system, which is an airplane with all that goes into it to make it a system. And then you know what your weapon or your equipment is going to be, then you make your people fit around it. And of course, the Army is an entirely different one. The Army is man-oriented, It's a question of a formation, and it had to have X number of people in it to be a viable organization. And then you provided the equipment to make that thing work operationally. Well, the army had gone through the trials and tribulations of cuts and so forth, and had tried to keep the manpower up and sacrificed equipment to do so. And here we were now with equipment that truly was on its last legs. I mean that. One of the things that we did get through, and that was, and of course now they're in a different, it's all been replaced, but we finally did get a program launched to re-equip the units with new vehicles, the new Jeeps and the three-quarter tons and the heavier military pattern vehicles. And those are not what I call fighting vehicles. Those are just straight movement transport vehicles. And it was that bad. The Jeeps were just unbelievable. You took a Jeep out and you just didn't know when it was going to quit, stop operating underneath you. Just quit, die. Well, it there were other priorities. I'm relating these because the SIGs, as I mentioned, even when, by the time I left the command, we still hadn't provided the SIGs regiment with a proper call, although it was still on the books. It was there. We knew as soon as money became available, it had to be done. Action has now been taken to clear that one up, but I would like to have seen it done the very next budget, but it was in, but it didn't stand screening. It had to come out because of just wasn't enough money, and we had to have money to keep the damn vehicles going. It was a question of robbing Peter to pay Paul, purely insufficient money. So the traveling around the command was an eye-opener, and it helped, as I say, it helped me enormously. Later on, in many of the discussions, many of the decisions we had to make, right away, quick, the fact that I'd had a chance to have a look-see helped me, certainly, to make up my mind which way we should go. And I found very soon that military is military. If it was running a command is not the operational side. There are major operational decisions to be made in a planning sense, but not in a tactical sense. You have your field commanders who make the decisions in a tactical sense, as we did do a little later on, where you put a good man in charge of an organization in a tactical sense, and he made his decisions, and he would inform Mobile Command Headquarters of what he'd done, and if he felt he had one that was a bit beyond his purview, then he would call, and there'd be a conference, and the commander would then say, okay, here's what it would be. But more often than not, this became a political thing, or the question of reallocation of resources. Not the pure tactical, in a pure military, army, land force sense, soldier sense of what was going on. So I found that I adapted to the command very quickly indeed. Mm-hmm. It was just to me another command. We had the same problems in administration and logistics, exactly the same problems. It was a question of where does your money go, where are your priorities. Once those were sorted out, then it was a question of allocating the funds. And knowing enough about the military or the tactical aspect to provide or recognize a decision when it was made and provide the necessary wherewithal to help the commander get on with his job. Well, one of the first things I had to do after I arrived was, again, there was this all these cutbacks, mm-hmm. all these terrible reductions. And there was, Mobile Command had been given a percentage reduction, I can't remember what it was. And it was a question of where the heck was the manpower going to come from. Well, I was told by the commander to chair a meeting. And, my God, talk about a terrible position to be thrust into without any preparation. Because we had, at this meeting, were representatives from all the Corps, the op staff, and no one wanted to give up a single body. And so the infighting started right the minute I sort of banged the gavel and said, well, the meeting is open. Everybody was making their case about why they should not give up a single person. And that included the docs and the dentists, right throughout the whole organization. And it was perhaps a good thing. Because I had to, in the space of that day, and it took all day, I had to coerce, threaten, cajole, every little trick in the book to get people to come down and finally admit that they could give up a person here or a few people there and so forth, and to gradually meet this total. But it was a terribly trying day. I can remember at the end of the day, I was absolutely exhausted, mentally, just exhausted, yeah. Because I had jumped all over the damn place, and as I say, pulled everything out that I had ever learned in trying to get people to do something which they didn't want to do. But it worked, and I was delighted. But there was one other little... there was an awful lot of unification came out in that conference. A lot of cracks about, well, now, if we weren't unified, we wouldn't be doing this sort of thing. And I'm now talking about internally in the Army, not airmen and an Army man fighting at all. And there was one particularly bright young lieutenant colonel, who now, by the way, is a 2-star general. I walked out with him afterwards, and I said, what did you think of that conference? And particularly, what did you think about all those remarks about unification and the problems and so forth? A very young post-war boy, of course, a brilliant young lad, had become a lieutenant colonel at a very young age. And he said, I don't see the problem. And it was rather revealing that there was a lot of emotion, and he had not grown up, of course, with the various elements, and therefore had not been exposed to a lot of the tradition, the emotional aspect of it. And he looked at it pretty coldly. And as a result, as he said, I don't see the problem, which was an eye opener for me. Well, the problem in the command was primarily one of trying to get new equipment, trying to keep the standard of training up. Attrition was a great problem. Particularly in the infantry units, what the hell can you do with lads, soldiers, after you've had them in a battalion for 3 years, 4 years? What do you do to make it still makes it exciting for them and interesting for them? On the technical trades, it wasn't quite so bad, because there was always something to do. A new challenge coming along, particularly with the old equipment that we had, and it was really a challenge to keep it going. But attrition was a terrible problem, and then finally the reserves. And then I, during the course of my time there, I had to head up a big study on the reserves, and that was an enormous job. But again, it was very, very interesting. It was related to the land reserves, not the air reserves. What do we do? How can we make the reserves more efficient, and where do we, or how do we go about it?
Well, they were being whittled down constantly at this time, as
they
I remember.
Were.
And if you, you know, you talk about the the regular forces.
That's right.
Having difficulty with equipment, with trucks, with vehicles, and all that sort of thing. As I remember, the reserves were going on World War II equipment.
Well, I think perhaps I'd even put a little bit worse than that. Whereas the regulars had some equipment, it may not work, but they had equipment. The reserves reached the point where they had no equipment.
Yeah.
No equipment.
Yeah. And damn little sympathy, as I
remember. And damn little sympathy, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, I put together a working group, and we worked on this pretty well full-time for nearly 4 months. And we did it by traveling across the country, visiting all the reserves, talking to the various commanders, the whole nine yards, and then sitting down and trying to figure out which way to go and how we would hack it. And it wound up as a full-blown, another full-blown study on the reserves. But it was interesting to see that after that was submitted to NDHQ, to see over a period of the next couple of years policies coming out which were in keeping with the recommendations that came out of that enormous study. One of the most important, which had always been a bugbear with the reserves, was a question of pay. Mm-hmm. How much money are they going to be paid? If you remember, originally the reserves were paid peanuts on a per diem basis, and then it was finally agreed that the reserve should be paid the same as a regular force man. If it puts in a full day, he should get a full day's pay, in accordance with the various trade structures and groupings and so forth, which apply to the regulars. Well, that was an enormous step forward, because it did at least put them on an equal footing. Now, there was, of course, then you ran into, well, that's going to cost money. Well, then how do you get over the additional costs and expenses? Part of it could be met by increasing the funds allotted to the reserves. The other, then, was to put a clamp on the number of days. Now, we actually wanted, as I recall, we wanted 30 days training a year for each militiaman, which would be spread out, say, a couple of weeks of training in the summertime, yeah, and the rest throughout the year, but full day. Yeah. And an evening's training was not a full day.
No, it was
only half day.
That's
right.
Yeah.
And in that way, try and get something the equivalent of 30 full days of training in a year, yeah, which we thought would be at least the beginning and train a lad. We had other grandiose ideas, and I still think they're valid, which were perhaps a little too revolutionary. That, for example, that when people leave the service voluntarily early, that they should be coerced into joining the reserves to finish off an obligation, if you will, to their country. Well, that smacks a wee bit of mobilization, or at least a conscription, and so, of course, it was just unacceptable from a political point of view.
Am I not correct in thinking that at present, and perhaps in your time too, when you had one of your regular soldiers, a trained soldier, shall we say, let's say he was with the forces for 3, 4, 5 years, and then he decides to get out into a civilian job for one reason or another, that there's no tabs kept on that man
That's
for
right.
future
That's right. That's right. This was another thing too. There were a multitude of administrative recommendations made. That the man, a tab should be kept on the man, very much so. And we again, he should be called back, or at least given the opportunity to come back for a couple of weeks training in the summertime. But a lot of those things became administratively just a little too difficult to handle with the setup that was in being at that time. Now I don't think it is. With computers and so forth, there's no difficulty in keeping a tab on a man. But Canadians are terribly mobile, and once a man moves from point A to point B, unless he lets the computer know one way or another, then he's lost. And the cost of keeping of following up on or keeping a tab on these people it takes manpower and it's money and so forth to do it. Whereas if it was ever I suppose a counter-argument would be that if ever there was an occasion when these people were required, there would be some form of mobilization call, and we assume that they would come forward, yeah, I suppose. Where that pays off, and if we could ever do this, is if we could have a system such as there is in Switzerland, mm-hmm, where, by law, every man, adult, between the ages of so-and-so and so-and-so, must put in his 2 weeks per annum in military training, mm-hmm, after having gone through an extended period of full-time training. And this is just keeping him up to speed. If we could do that, then I think we'd be we'd be very close to being home. I think that this problem is going to become even worse because we're entering into a period the next few years in the 80s when we do know that there's going to be a manpower shortage in this country. And therefore, the problem of manning the military, regular, not just let's just say regular and reserves, yeah, is going to be an extremely difficult problem. There's going to be a great deal of competition for every man that's available in this country. And maybe it might get so difficult that something like the Swiss policy may have to be adopted if Canada is going to have anything in the way of a military force at all. I would like to see that happen because it only has to happen once and then the law is there, and then in a period when we have lots of manpower, it still is applicable and it's good training. I believe the military training is good just for lads anyway, regardless. Well, one of the other things that came out of that study was that we should try and run a better program in the summertime for the reserves. Now, that one did click because at that time, again, there was the unemployment situation was not bad, but they were unemployed, and there was a question of trying to do something in the summertime to keep the kids off the streets and so forth. The younger university student and the senior high school student sort of thing. And so we ran these summer programs. We were asked by the government to tee them up on very short notice. And again, because the mobile command has the infrastructure, we were able to do it in a matter of just a very few weeks, get the whole thing organized and off and running. And it was in the first one, I guess it would be about 70, I think, was the first summer. We did it for 2 years, 1771 or 71, 72, can't remember precisely. But I do remember how successful it was. And there were many things. I can remember receiving a phone call one day from which the secretary put through to me. And it was a man. And she warned me. She said, "This man seems to be pretty upset. And the commander's away, and he wants to speak to the commander." And he gave me his name, if I can remember. I said, "All right, put him on." And as soon as I said, "This is General Lane," this chap said, "What have you done with my son?" And I said, "Well, no, I'm not too sure." No, I didn't laugh, but my God, what son? Where was he? And what? And so I said, "Well, I'm sorry. Now, perhaps you could tell me what the problem is." And he said, "Well, my son was in the summer training program." And he said, "I just want to know what you've done to him." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry. I don't know what we've done to him. What seems to be the problem?" And he said, "Well, I've never seen such a change in my lad, in a lad in all my life. He's making his own bed. He's cut his hair. He's just changed so much. I want to know what you did to him." So there were several sort of reactions like that,
yeah,
which implied that the program had side effects that we really had not anticipated, which was good.
Yeah.
I mean, that's good PR.
Yeah.
And it countered those who perhaps felt that, and there were some parents who initially felt that their sons were being taught to kill.
Yeah.
Of course, that program, that summer program, was not that. It was more of a citizenship program than it was a military program. As a matter of fact, it was only in about the last week that they even saw a weapon, much less fire one or handle one. It was primarily a citizenship adventure training, how to survive out in the bush, and first aid, that
yeah.
type of training, with discipline as
yeah.
being the center of the whole thing.
Was this done, Reg, through the units? Presumably
mm-hmm.
it was at the regular
we
militia
had to,
camps.
We had to do it at the main training areas, Valcartier, Gagetown, Petawawa,
yeah.
with other wherever there was a training area. Now there was one just out small training area just outside Montreal. And not very big, couldn't handle very many people, could only handle about perhaps 75. And I remember going out, I happened to visit that one day because it was pouring with rain. I'll just go out and see how these kids are doing. It was really they were under canvas. Sorry, under pop tents, they weren't even under good canvas. And just as I got there, or about a few minutes before I got there, the clouds broke and the sun came out and it was a glorious day. But everything was soaking wet. And here were these kids, and they were high school students. They were all 17, somewhere in there. Well, I expected them, all their tails down between their legs, and their heads down, and soaking up. Hell no. They were all teed up. They'd slept out all night in that pouring rain. They were all soaking wet, and here they were now, everything drying out, and they'd survived the night. And it was just the greatest experience they'd ever had, and their morale was just sky high. I talked to all kinds of them. Did they enjoy it? And they said, "Yeah, it was great fun," and would they come back again next year? You're darn right, because this was just the greatest thing. Mostly these were kids from Montreal, you see, who'd probably never been out, not had much opportunity
yeah.
out in the country, and lived in camp in the country.
Yeah.
And here they were it was being done under supervision. They were having to cook everything out themselves. And
yeah.
It was just great. It was, a higher level of scout training, if
yeah.
I could put it that way.
Yeah. Eagle Scouts.
Eagle Scouts, right. with just very limited supervision, because the regular force was spread pretty thin in running these camps, and they were all over the place, and we were trying to get people off on leave during the summertime as well. But we did ask the militia to help, and the militia came forward, and they provided a hell of a lot of people for basic training and for the administration of the camps. And so they did do a good job, and on a full-time basis. Those militia who were available for full-time summer employment. Now, the cost of all that came out of the special pot that the government had brought, put forward to look, run that thing. Didn't want a D&D's hide. Although there was a lot of equipment that we used and so forth, which is bound to happen, that type of thing. Yeah. Certain stores were used. But we did try to keep a check on total costs so that we could recover. Or let's put it this way, it wouldn't come out of the D&D hide and have an effect for the rest of the year. Well, I was very taken with that, and I still feel that even today, that with the unemployment situation being where it is, that instead of a lot of money going into unemployment benefits, some of it should be diverted into that type of training on a little more permanent basis, not just a summer type of thing, to get some of these people in and let them have this type of training. I feel very strongly that they'd be better men for having had that exposure. Sure, there are those who will they either won't take to it or will be turfed out, but they, I'm sure, would be the exception. We had, I'm trying to remember, but I think out of the, I wish I could remember the exact number that we brought in. It was in the thousands that we handled during those two summers. And I seem to recall that we only had two or three cases of where we actually had to let people go.
Yeah.
I was staggered. I thought it would be a difficult program. There would be a lot of rebellion, and we'd get people who would just be adamant and say, to hell with you, I don't have to be here, and I'm going to leave, because it was voluntary.
Yeah. Now, and, were they... they would be in uniform, an army uniform.
We provided them with, we provided them where we go and got it. Equipping them was a hell of a problem. They were given the work dress, the field kits and field dress and so forth, which is about the only thing we had. And some of them didn't fit very well. Yeah. No, everything came out of stores. Everything we had.
Would they be associated with any regiment under which they trained?
No, they weren't.
No badges?
Not directly. No. It was just a straight matter of getting them into... The only reason for those clothes was because so much of it was out in the bush and in the field. They had to have something that would stand up to the wear and tear. No, it was no direct affiliation. Now, where this did come in was at the end. Towards the end of the first summer, then the individual units who were located in that particular town or were providing the support or where the lads came from would then approach the boys and say, would you be interested in joining the militia and our unit and continue with this kind of thing? And we picked up a lot of people, a lot of lads joined the militia as a result of that exposure. But it was done, again, on a voluntary basis, but not while they were training. We were meticulous in making this a non-military training camp for the very reason that we didn't want people to get any idea that we were running what would be the equivalent of conscription or enforced military training. Quite the reverse.
Yeah.
If in the second year, those who had come back, who had been in the first year and came back the second year, then we made them leaders. Then we began to give them, and not only were they some of the leaders, but they began to pick up a bit more of military training.
Yeah.
I've always had a theory that if we could do this, we could get these young people, set up a system whereby we could have them for a couple of months each summer.
Yeah.
At the end of 4 years, you would have had the equivalent of a full year of what has been used to be the call-up system of training, and you'd have a fairly well-trained young lad who, if he also became a part of the militia, would be reasonably well-trained, and it wouldn't take long in the event of an emergency.
Yeah.
It would be a matter of days rather than months, as it would take with people right off the street, to whip him into shape. To bring him up to a standard where he could take over. And it would give us. I still maintain. Having seen the results of two summers when it, as I say, 70-71. Having seen the results of what could be done with a few thousand lads, and the reports that we got back, I'm very taken with it, and I wish there was some way we could do this all the time. And I even, again, as a part of that reserve, that type of training, and seeing what could be done with lads, and the need for people to be trained to assist in the event of a civil emergency, aid to the civil power, I felt that we should also, when a lad came into the armed forces, that his first period of training regardless of where he was going, whether it would be land, sea, or air, or what his trade was going to be, that he should spend about the first 6 to 9 months of his service actually in an infantry unit, being trained as an infantryman first. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of 9 months of full-time training, he would learn how and know how to take care of himself in the field.
Yeah.
He would have learned how to handle a weapon well.
Mm-hmm.
He would have done a fair amount of shooting. He would know what it was all about. And, of course, would have had that kind of discipline that you get only in an infantry unit of working together as a team, a platoon, or a section, whatever it might be.
Get him under a good sergeant major.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's yeah. right. Then let him go. Then let him go off to whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. He could be an airman, he could be a seaman, he could be a technician, whatever it might be. But at least then you'd have, if you needed suddenly to call out your armed forces to help, in a difficult situation, you'd have people who had been trained to respond as infantrymen. And God darn it, when you get down to aid to the civil power, what you're primarily confronted with is aid to the civil power, and you need extremely well-trained people. And now, it was the FLQ crisis that convinced me that this is what we should do.
Yeah.
Well, again, it was a policy that was again a little bit too. I actually put that forward. It was a policy that was just a little too radical, and it never was. It never was accepted.
How did the CDS feel about this training? Or was
the summer training?
Yeah.
I honestly don't know. I never really had the opportunity to discuss it in any detail with the CDS. I guess it would have been, at that time, it would have been Jean Allard, I guess.
Yeah.
I think, it would have been... Jean Victor, no, wait a minute, Jean Victor, no, Freddie Sharp, I guess, would have come in at that time. Freddie Sharp took over from Jean Victor Allard, if I recall correctly, and I guess it would have been Freddie Sharp's period. yes, I guess it was. But I never had the chance to really discuss it, because I suppose it was almost after the fact that it began to sink in, and I began to hear these reports and see the reports that were coming in from the various units and how it had gone. And the editorial was being written.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all positive. Mm-hmm. Yes, very positive, not negative.
Yeah.
So I began to think about it and realize that maybe there was something here that would be of great use and help us in this training of the youth of the country. But anyway, it was... we have not picked it up. We haven't done anything about it.
Yeah.
And since. And I think it's a great regret. The government is spending large sums of money in various fields, training fields, and so forth. But by golly...